This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The greatest treasure hunt in American fiction turns 75 this month.
Now let's talk about the Blackbird.
Let's. Mr. Spade, have you any conception of how much money can be got for that Blackbird?
No.
Well, sir, if I told you. I told you half. You'd call me a liar.
That Blackbird is the Maltese Falcon, of course. But long before Humphrey Bogart and Sidney Greenstreet haggled over it on the silver screen, the story of the sought-after statuette first scrolled off the typewriter of author Dashiell Hammett. Hammett didn't invent the hard-boiled detective genre, but he did produce its archetype, Sam Spade, the complex, hard-nosed loner with a set of morals and motives all his own. From its publication on Valentine's Day in 1930, the book spawned three movie adaptations, including, if you can believe this, a comedy with Bette Davis. Several generations of authors who claim him for their inspiration also followed. But for all that, by the time he died, Hammett was nearly penniless and hadn't published a novel in more than 30 years. In this hour of Talk of the Nation, we'll discuss the man, his masterwork, and his place in American literature. Later on in the program, controversial remarks stir debate over academic freedom, but for now, we want to hear from you. Do you have some connection to Hammett or the book, a good story about the famous Falcon to share with us, or just some question about the genre that Dashiell Hammett's work spawned or at least became associated with? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest this hour is Richard Lehman, executor of Hammett's literary estate and editor of a volume of his letters. He joins us from member station WLTR in Columbia, South Carolina. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, when I was getting ready for this show and the producer said to me, well, you know, have you read the book? I thought, oh, of course I've read the book. And then I realized after I'd actually picked up a copy that I hadn't read the book, but that I was convinced I had because I'd seen the movie. And so what do you lose if you've seen the movie Maltese Falcon, but you haven't read the book by Dashiell Hammett, which I've now read, but I'm curious what you lose.
Well, it's a good question. I think the first thing you lose is a sense of Hammett's characters as Hammett imagined them. You see Hammett's characters as John Huston imagined them and as they were played, sometimes artfully, by Sidney Greenstreet, for example, as Gutman, and Peter Lorre as Jules Cairo, and Bogart as Spade. Maybe not exactly as Hammett imagined. Many people disagree with me, but I think Mary Astor is not the best Bridget O'Shaughnessy. But the remarkable thing about that movie is it's one of the handful of great American movies that is very closely based on a great American novel. It happens very rarely. You see great movies that are based on lousy novels, lousy movies that are based on great novels, but having the two come together doesn't happen very often. I think one of the reasons that it happened was because Huston had an abiding respect for Hammett's work. When he made his novel, he adhered very closely to the book. He cut parts as he needed to make them fit into the space of a screenplay. But he used Hammett's dialogue whenever it was possible. And he had a mindset that was close to Hammett's, I think.
You know, it's funny, though, because the characters are so vividly drawn in the movie, it's very hard to read the dialogue, even in the book, and not hear the voices of Sidney Greenstreet or Peter Lorre or Humphrey Bogart. So
I agree with you.
It's a sort of a problem, I mean, for people who were born after 1940 and might have seen the film first.
I must have read the book 30 times. Each time I read it, I find something new and amazing about it. And at the same time, I can't read those Gutman speeches without seeing Sidney Greenstreet leaning back in that big leather chair.
Oh.
I can't see this the scene with Joel Cairo in Spade's office without seeing Peter Lorre, who is absolutely perfect, both of them.
Yeah. So Sam Spade is really the character that drives, you know, the Maltese Falcon. What makes him such an enduring character of literature, do you think?
I think several things. First of all, he's a character who faces the same kinds of difficulties that other great American writers were dealing with at the time, the sort of cultural malaise that followed World War One. You know, what do you do in a time when there are no rules and when the institutions that former generations relied on for guidance seem to have failed? Spade faces that same dilemma that Hemingway's characters, for example, face. Spade faces them, though, not as a man who's victimized by those forces, but a man who prevails over them. He is the embodiment of strength, the strength of mind, the strength of body, the strength of character that it takes to formulate principles that are meaningful, principles that have the effect of enriching society, principles that aren't totally selfish. I think that, first of all. Mm-hmm. Second, Spade is just a realistic-seeming character.
Yeah.
You know, the dialogue, the vernacular that Hammett provides for him is, to me, totally believable. And even though the language of the book is not necessarily always the language of today, you know, he's using the slang of the 20s and underworld slang, still it's utterly believable, I think.
It's interesting. Yes, it in a way, it's another problem. The language is picked up by, and the style of speech was, I mean, there must be dozens, if not hundreds, of detectives that followed Sam Spade that kind of picked up this tough guy attitude, and that it's hard not to think of it as cliched, but this was very original. And yet I wonder, did Sam Spade come out of any literary tradition, or was his antecedent in literature, or was this really a one-off or a new thing?
It was a new thing. Mm-hmm. That's why it was so remarkable, I think. And, you know, his antecedent was not in literature, but it was in the streets. Hammett had himself worked as a Pinkerton's detective for several years. He had cases involving jewel thieves, and although I guess you could call Gutman a jewel thief in a way, he had dealt with the kind of people who inhabit his books. He had worked with Sam Spade's, and indeed, I would argue that he was Sam Spade. That piece that you read at the top of the show, a portion of which begins the novel, describing Sam Spade and the V's of his face, is a description of Hammett as he looked at about the time he wrote the novel. You can hold a picture of Hammett in one hand and read that passage, you know, from the book held in the other hand, and you know, you see where it came from. When Hammett wrote the introduction to the Modern Library edition of the novel in 1934, he said that Sam Spade had no direct antecedent, that he was a dream man. He was an idealization of what every private detective hoped he might be. I would argue that he was an idealization of what Hammett himself thought he might be.
We're talking with Richard Lehman, the executor of Dashiell Hammett's literary estate, about the Maltese Falcon, which celebrates which has its 75th anniversary since its publication this month. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can send an email, totn@npr.org. We'd like to hear some recollection from you of your experience with the book or the movie or some factor in Dashiell Hammett's life that you'd like to know more about. Coming back to you, Richard Lehman, when Hammett sat down to write The Maltese Falcon in 1928, he'd already written three of the six novels that he would ever publish. Was he at the top of his game at this point as a writer, do you think?
It was three of the five.
Three of the five,
actually.
Sorry.
Yeah, he struggled for So 6 years, 25 years, really, to write that sixth, mm-hmm. and never was able to get it out. He was at the top of the game. Not only that, he knew it. He knew it without a doubt. When he sent the Maltese Falcon to his editor, I'm sorry, when he sent the Dane Curse, his book before the Maltese Falcon, to the editor, he told her that he was working on a new book now. And it was that unlike most moderately literate people, he felt that there was some hope to turn the detective form to the purposes of real literature, and that he was selfish. He used that word selfish enough to think that he might do it. He was reaching for the stars with the Maltese Falcon. He hadn't done it before. He set a standard that was higher than any he had ever achieved before. In fact, he set a standard that was too high for him, even. I think he reached it once again in The Glass Key, his next novel. Then it was it had almost a destructive effect on him. May I say also that I'm not the trustee, not the executor for the estate, but rather a trustee of the Literary Property Trust. There's a subtle distinction to be made, and I don't want to offend my friends in the Hammett family.
Don't want to get into trouble. Okay, let's take a quick call before we have to take a break and go to Steve in Kansasville, Wisconsin. Steve, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Maltese Falcon. In fact, my wife and I recently watched it again, and we've also been watching the Thin Man series, which was Hammett also had created. And I was interested that he didn't end up well, but he did have a great influence on me. I ghostwrite children's detective fiction books, and even though it's a lot less hard-boiled than Sam Spade, Hammett is, boy, he's the original. He's the one that all this came from.
All right, Steve, thanks for that comment, and right now we have to take a quick break. When we return, detective novelist Robert Parker joins us to talk about the classic mystery of Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon. What did you find fascinating or puzzling about the novel? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking with author Richard Lehman about the mystique of the Maltese Falcon. You're invited to join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take a call from Greg in Phoenix, Arizona. Greg, welcome to the program.
Oh, glad to be here.
What's your comment?
Well, it's a little story. My wife is a big, big fan of the movie. Owned it for years. And several years back, in one of the catalogs we get, they had a Maltese Falcon reproduction. It was cast concrete or something, because it was very heavy, enameled black, and I was able to procure it without her finding out. And at the time she was teaching, I had a male friend wear his trench coat up and his fedora down and go staggering into the teacher's room at lunchtime, full of teachers, and muttered, "The fat man fell on the floor and dropped that at her feet." And I had it wrapped up in newspaper and twine. She knew instantly what it was, and that set the gold standard for birthday presents since then. So.
You want to be careful not to peek too soon on those.
Yeah, it's been hard. I've come close a few times since then, but that was it. I haven't been able to touch it.
Yeah, very nice. That's a great story, Greg. Thanks very much for calling with that.
Thank you.
Richard Lehman, I guess you've probably heard examples of how the Maltese Falcon has been worked into various either pieces of literature. I guess, did Woody Allen bring it up in his movie Play It Again, Sam? I can't recall.
Oh, yeah, he did. Rowan and Martin made a movie called The Maltese Bippy. Absolutely nothing to do with the Maltese Falcon except for the title. But, there's an interesting thing about that statuette. The movie that was cast for the 1941 movie, or the statuette cast for the 41 movie, was made of lead, weighed about 55 pounds. And Bogart, who wasn't a large man, complained that it was too heavy to be carting around the way he had to cart. So there, in the production budget, there is an item for a plastic cast of the Maltese Falcon that'll be easier for Bogie to deal with.
Interesting. And interesting. Well, a little piece of Maltese Falcon history there. We're joined now from his home in Boston by one of the modern masters of the hard-boiled genre, Robert Parker. His latest Spencer novel, Cold Service, comes out next month. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how has the archetype of the private detective evolved since the days of Hammett and, I guess, Raymond Chandler, who was a contemporary, another great crime novelist?
Well, there's hello to Richard Layman, by the way, from here in Titletown, USA, may I say. Chandler said once of Hammett that he may not have been the first, but he was the ace performer. And he took murder away from the people who did it with Curare and Tropical Fish and gave it to the people who habitually practiced that craft. And he told the stories in the language that they habitually used. It was a major shift, and it's a shift that reflects a literary shift from England to America in that whole period. Chandler took that and added to it a certain gorgeousness because he was Chandler. I don't think he decided to update Hammett. He just wrote Hammett-like stories in Chandler-like way. And I stole from both of them, and here we are.
Huh. Well, I still enjoy reading The Sign of Four, which I think is your Curare reference, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to picture, Richard Layman said to us earlier that Dashiell Hammett captured the language that was the language of the day, of the 20s. But I'm wondering, does the hard-boiled detective say the same and the language change, or has the whole nature of what it means to be hard-boiled in 2000 differ from what it meant to be hard-boiled in 1920?
I think the language has changed dramatically. The language of music, the language of film, the language of literature. It always does. I mean, we're talking about 80 years here. It doesn't sound the same. It's still the language of Hammett and the language of Chandler and everybody else's language who was any good at writing this stuff is, of course, not an accurate reflection of the way people talk. It's sort of a kind of music that writers make up as they go along. Just as the music changes, the dialogue changes, the description changes. I don't think it necessarily means a change in the basic nature of the hard-boiled hero.
Right.
But he just talks the way men of his age talk, the powerful Chandler.
Right. Let's listen to what some of our callers have to say about this, and let's go to Audrey in Little Rock, Arkansas. Audrey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm literally out shopping today and listening to the radio station, and people across the country love hearing things like this.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to tell you that I have been to Hammett's grave at Arlington Cemetery. He had been in the service many years ago, served up in Alaska, I believe. But my story that I think you may find of interest dealing with the subject at hand regarding is mystery writing. Many years ago, I was interviewing Hyman Brown. Mr. Brown was one of the preeminent characters in the birth of broadcasting in the United States. He was the producer of the Thin Man series on the radio. And he told me that he had put together musical segues for the broadcast. This would be the little pieces of music, generally like organs playing in between commercials and then the opening and the closing of the radio program. And he said he invited Hammett to listen to this, and it included the voices of Nick and Nora Charles talking, just saying little sweet nothings to one another, and the barking dog Asta. And as Hammett sat there listening, he seemed to have a very concerned look on his face. And then Hyman Brown himself used the phrase. He said, Hammett was an angel of a man. And he said, after I finished all of this, I said, well, what do you think? And he said, I'm sorry, you can't use it. And he said, well, my money is invested in this, all this time and effort. What do you mean we can't use it? And he said, MGM owns the dog. I never wrote the dog. You've got a barking dog throughout. You're going to have to take that out of everything. And so, in fact, he did.
Wow. Good story.
Well, I am very grateful that you have programs like this. I'm on the National Board for Public Broadcast, and feel very strongly about what public broadcast can provide the people in America. And again, I'm grateful for what you have here, and I'm thrilled to have been part of this program.
Oh, well, thanks for joining us. It's very nice to talk to you, Audrey.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's take another call now from Kara in San Francisco. Kara, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm in San Francisco.
Yes.
Dashiell Hammett's home.
Yes.
And thank you for having this this program about him.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm a writer, and I write mysteries set in Paris. But Dashiell Hammett inspired me. And I just want to say, at our local Mystery Writers of America meeting we had about 2 weeks ago, we had it at the restaurant where Dashiell Hammett used to go. Of course, I've forgotten the name.
Oh, of course. All right.
They have the newspaper.
I'm sorry,
and all the memorabilia.
Kara, hold on a second. There. Richard Lehman, did you say you remember the name of the restaurant?
Yes, John's Grill.
John's Grill.
Thank
on Ellis Street.
All right, Kara, well, thanks for that. Next time you go to John's Grill, you'll have to tell them that we had a chat about this on the radio.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We also have an email here from a bit of, I guess it's Maltese Falcon trivia. It comes from Cy in Berkeley, California. He writes, your guest knows that off Bush Street in San Francisco, above the Stockton Street Tunnel, is a plaque commemorating the spot where Bridget Shaughnessy shot Miles Archer. And the other thing he says is many years ago, possibly still now, the Sacramento Yellow Pages had a listing for Archer and Spade private detectives. So that's a nice piece of Maltese Falcon trivia. But Robert Parker, I wonder if I can come back to you.
Sure.
You know, the book takes place in San Francisco, and Dashiell Hammett was living in San Francisco at the time. And then we just heard from the caller who said she wrote about, you know, mystery novels in Paris. What do you think about the idea of being in the city where your mystery or your story takes place? Is that an important thing, and is it especially important for mystery writers?
I think it is very useful for any writer to write about a place he knows as opposed to a place he doesn't know. And it also saves research, which is a nice thing. Hammett wrote about San Francisco, Chandler wrote about Los Angeles, I write about Boston. That's because he lived in San Francisco and Chandler lived in L.A. and I live in Boston.
Right, right. Is there something, in the way Dashiell Hammett set up plots, especially the Maltese Falcon had a lot of twists and turns, was that also something that helped reporters, writers who came after him, or was that a fairly common thing in mystery novels at that point?
Well, I'm not sure I'm expert enough to answer that. I don't do too many twists and turns.
Uh-huh.
I mean, as a working writer, one of the reasons you have twists and turns is so the book will be long enough. let's see, how many twists and turns am I going to need? I'm on page 220, you know. I don't think that there was anything in Hammett's twists and turns that made it more or less likely that anyone else would do it. No.
All right. Interesting.
His language and his, for lack of a better word, realism, and the hard, flat look at the world that he gave us is what he left us, I think.
All right. Well, Robert Parker, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Robert Parker is the author of several detective series, and he spoke to us from his home in Boston. The TV movie adaptation of Stone Cold airs later this month. Richard Lehman, I'd like to come back a little bit to Dashiell Hammett's life after The Maltese Falcon. He continued to he did write some more, but then things went a little bit south for him. Can you describe some of that?
Well, the success of The Maltese Falcon and the Thin Man movies, Hammett's good jobs in Hollywood, gave him a lot of money. He was married, still devoted to his family, but living as a single man. He was making, in the worst year of the Depression, about $100,000 a year. That at a time when the average American family was making about $800. He had the money, he had the freedom, and he had the celebrity to succumb to every temptation that came his way. And he rarely missed an opportunity to succumb. He drank heavily. He had house accounts at brothels in Los Angeles. He lived in hotel suites at the Beverly Wilshire. He was driven around by a chauffeur when he was in Los Angeles.
and he had no respect for the work that he was doing and for the people that he was working with. Within 6 years, he had a total physical and mental collapse to the point where Lillian Hellman came from New York, picked him up, put him on an airplane, and took him home to New York, to her house.
And Lillian Hellman became his companion, this presumably after his marriage had ended.
Well, his marriage didn't end.
Oh, it didn't?
No, he was still married. He was still devoted to his family. He had tuberculosis. He wasn't able in the mid-20s. They had to move away, and he got used to his freedom and maintained it. He met Hellman in November 1930. They were lovers for a time, lifelong devoted companions. But Hellman took him back. He eventually sobered up. He became interested in politics. It gave him something to believe in and something to work for, which is to say the underdog. He served in World War II, ran afoul of a federal court judge who wanted him to testify about his associations within the Communist Party. Served nearly 6 months in jail for contempt of court. Got out. IRS got on his tail. Attached all of his income, and he lived essentially as a pauper for most of the decade of the 50s. He was ill and he was poor, but he wasn't broken.
We're talking with Richard Layman about Dashiell Hammett and the famous novel, The Maltese Falcon. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You know, we were talking about Lillian Hellman, and Hammett based his novel, The Thin Man, on himself and Lillian Hellman, writing about a sharp-tongued, heavy-drinking pair of married sleuths named Nick and Nora. We have a clip of the resulting movie in which Nick, played by Humphrey Bogart, deflects Nora Myrna Loy's jealousy about a young woman they've just met.
Pretty girl.
Yeah, she's a very nice type.
You got types?
Only you, darling. Lanky brunettes with wicked jaws.
Now, as I listen to that, I realize it can't be right. That's not Humphrey Bogart. There's another actor in there playing...
William Powell.
William Powell, of course. But was that anything, that snappy repartee, anything like how Hammett and Hellman were in real life?
I can only guess about that.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Didn't know him. I think the Thin Man was based on their relationship. Moreover, I think there's a strong case to be made that Hellman had a considerable role in at least editing the novel. It shows her influence. The Thin Man is different from any of Hammett's previous four novels. There's a different tone to it. There's a different attitude to it. He was writing about their relationship, and at the same time, he was helping her write The Children's Hour, her first play, which ran for over a year on Broadway, which was a huge success, and for which he gave her the idea, and in which he collaborated with her. He even wrote some of the speeches in that play.
All right. Well, we have time for one more quick call. Let's go to Lou in San Francisco. Briefly, what's your question or observation?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling from the noir streets of the outer Richmond in San Francisco.
Ah.
I actually have a story. My aunt, it's been about 10 years, sold the actual Maltese Falcon, the prop that was used in the movie. She was married to the actor William Conrad, who was given the prop when he left Warner Brothers. He was a former on the show Cannon and
Yes,
Batman.
Of course.
He was given the prop. She owned it. She was about to sell it in the Loma Prieta earthquake, I think it was 92. It fell over on their house, and my aunt, forgetting the story of the movie, saw some scratches on it, went to take some nail polish to cover up the scratches of, you know, if you recall that, the scratches in the movie revealing that it is in fact lead. The irony is that she was about to cover the scratches and thought better of it, went to sell it to be, I think it was the highest selling prop of the movie that had ever been sold. So it was just a funny reverse of fortune with that event.
Lou. That's a great story. Thanks so much for calling. And I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to leave it, but perhaps that's as good a place as any. Richard Layman, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Richard Layman, one of the authors of Hard-Boiled Mystery Writers, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, Ross MacDonald. He is also the literary executor of Dashiell Hammett's estate. He joined us from member station WLTR in Columbia, South Carolina. When we come back from a short break, the status of academic freedom on university campuses. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.